Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to always think that a program can empower us, to give us insights and information that can change the quality of our lives. That's what we try to do every day with this program. As you'll see today, when we begin by sharing about, does having children make us happier? You'd think, because isn't that what so many people say will really bind the relationship? And how many people are going through a crisis in their relationship feel that having a child would make a difference? Does it? The London School of Economics shares their insights on that. Radiation exposure is linked to aggressive thyroid cancers. Researchers confirmed for the first time, University of California, San Francisco. Well, what does that mean then for all the people living around nuclear power plants who've had an increased risk of an actual occurrence of thyroid cancer? There are people listening right now who live within 8 miles of Indian Point. 3 people within one family have thyroid cancer. They don't smoke, they don't drink, they don't have their risk factors, and yet they're still living there. They just don't get it. Or they get it, and they choose not to go through the discomfort of moving because of, well, the whole idea of living with comfort. We'll deal with that. Women who eat fruits and vegetables have healthier arteries. Well, that means you're going to have less likelihood of having heart attacks. A good study there in the American College of Cardiology. And the government researchers, they're saying this, not independent people. Flu shots not effective in the elderly, after all. Well, gee whiz, weren't we saying that? Yes. Repeatedly, didn't we write that in several articles? Yes. Fully documenting? Well, is this brand new information? No, it's not. What we've been telling you all along, and what we've been reporting in our articles, and just so you understand, all the articles that I write, and I'm writing about 1 to 2 per month, are always vetted by scholars and residents for accuracy and objectivity, and then our team of attorneys go through them as well to make sure that we are on point on all of the issues. It's the same information. So how is it we had this information out 4 years ago, and they're just revealing this today? That means they've known about it, they haven't told you about it. Do you remember when I said that every time you speak, even in a normal voice, even the voice I'm using right now, is projecting water, tiny little water beads from your mouth out? Now, you wouldn't see them unless the room was freezing cold. Then you would see it because you would see the condensation. You would see it coming out. In a normal conversation, you're propelling through the air, water. In that water could be viruses or bacteria. Who's saying this? MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, confirms what many of us have been saying about Ebola all along. If the virus is real and spreading as claimed, part of this spread is occurring via the airborne transmission through things like coughs and sneezes. And MIT researchers found that these particles can, in some cases, travel 20 feet, but if you sneeze, much further. If someone's talking very loud, very far. Now, I did the research on this years ago and found that when they wanted to see why people in Parliament in England were coming down with colds and flu on a frequent basis, and lots of them, they took an opera singer and they sprayed a non-pathogenic bacteria in the throat and then just had him talk with a very strong voice. And they put petri dishes on every single seat. The next day, the furthest part, which is about 60 feet, was fully contaminated. So when it goes out of your mouth, the air and the particulate matter, it wafts around in the air. It can land. And then the bacteria and viruses can live hours, days, months, depending upon what type it is, on surface areas. More on that. a commentary from Michael Parenti Global Research on our sense of exceptionalism and what we exclude from this, what we rewrite. Well, we're going to be very honest about our exceptionalism today. I think you'll find it of interest. Also today, we're going to talk about Roundup, the herbicide, the most popular herbicide in the world, and birth defects. Is the public being intentionally kept in the dark? From our environmental segment, we'll show you what the industry has known, the government has known, and all European regulators have known since the 1980s and 90s, that Roundup, the world's best-selling herbicide, causes birth defects, but they failed to inform the public. Also, in the next few days, there will be voting in Oregon and in Colorado about whether to label genetically modified foods. Tens of millions of dollars is being spent to say, no, we don't want them regulated, we don't want them labeled. Very little money is able to be spent on those who want them regulated to the degree that they at least would be identified, they'd be labeled. Two things that we can do today, everyone in this audience. Watch the video. You can go to Gary Knoll and then go to YouTube, Seeds of Death. It literally deconstructs the entire lie, the myth, that genetically engineered food has been tested safe. It has not. That it's effective and can prevent massive amounts of starvation cases. It does not. In fact, everything about GMOs is a lie. The documentary with the best experts in the world, it was filmed all over the world, by the way, is there. So that's one. And then share it. Share it with as many people, as many places you can today. Also, on our website, there is an article. The article was published this week, and it's by Richard Gale, scholar-in-residence, myself, and it's about GMOs, the new walking dead. Apropos, timely, every pro-GMO argument that is given, we deconstruct it. The politics behind it, we show you. The people behind it, we show them at what they're doing and their dirty work. You really need this, and share it. So this is the day when, if you can do nothing else to make it a better world because of work and commitments, which are understandable, watch it, share it as far and as wide as you can. We only have a few days, and in Oregon, which is neck and neck, yes and no, it's about equal. And they'll be putting millions more in the next few days. We don't have that advantage. But we can put the truth and get the video out there. Does having children make us any happier? Here's what this says. I'll quote it. The birth of a first and second child briefly increases the level of their parents' happiness. But a third child does not, or those after. According to new research at the London School of Economics and Western University in Canada. According to the research published in the journal Demography, parents' happiness increases in the year before and after the birth of a first child. It then quickly decreases and returns to their pre-child level of happiness. The pattern for second births is similar, although the increase in happiness before and around the birth is roughly half that of the first birth. And the increase in happiness surrounding the birth of a third child is non-existent. And, quote, the fact that parental happiness increases before these children are born suggests that we are capturing broader issues relating to childbearing, such as couples forming partnerships and making plans for a future. The arrival of a third child is not associated with an increase in the parents' happiness. So, then, what happens after the first year? All right, that they didn't address, but I think it's very important. I see this all the time in the building that I live in, in New York, where people will run their dogs out to the street in the morning. They take them to the curb, and then they run them back upstairs. Generally, at some point in the day, you'll see, for not all of them, but some of them, there's a dog walking service that comes out and takes dogs down to Riverside Park and then back. And then in the evening, you'll see the same ritual, running down and back. All day long, all that dog is wanting is to be with that person. Now the question is, how much happiness does that person find from being with the dog? How much time do they give the dog? How much attention and time do they give the dog? That would be true for birds or for cats or any other pet that a person has. The same for children. I'm finding something really unusual right now. I've been counseling some women in their 40s. All these women happen to be in their 40s. They all have some health issues. But they're all highly educated. Most have master's degrees. Most were very successful at one point, easily considered upper middle class and some wealthy class. Today, they're all poor. They've gone through divorces. They've raised their children. The children are in college. And they don't have the support, financial support. They've taken other jobs. And now it's hard to even have those jobs. And as one woman said, she's just 1 week away from being homeless. And she's trying to find something very inexpensive. And she could afford no more than $500 a month in a shared environment, because everything she's tried to do works. And then someone else comes in, and she says there's a lot of ageism where someone younger is willing to work for less, and she's not making much, so little that she has no cash, she has debt on credit card, no savings, and a bleak future. But in the process of these conversations, several of them were babysitting, in effect, kind of a nanny, getting paid that way. And that was particularly interesting to me, because I said, well, who are the people? I don't need their names. I'm not asking for you to tell me that. But what do they do? And are these couples or singles? Here's what two of them had to say. And that the women that they work for, who they take care of a child each, these people don't know each other, by the way. It's just the same story. One of the women is a very successful scientist at a major laboratory. She's a heavy income earner, has the big house out in Long Island, very prestigious, travels all over the world on a regular basis lecturing. And for about 14 hours a day, this woman takes care of her child and loves the child and gives the child a lot of attention and quality time. But when the mother comes home, she's tired. She spends very little time with her daughter. And the daughter's already eaten, already gotten ready for bed, and she kind of tucks her in. But then she goes into her office and works, and then gets up very early and is out. No quality time, even on the weekends, with her daughter. But everything the daughter needs materially is supplied, including nannies and caregivers. Something similar with the other one. A woman who is very successful. She is 45, works on Wall Street, very influential jobs in purchase and acquisitions, always on the phone, lots of traveling, has a daughter. The daughter is 6. This woman takes care of her, works about 12 hours a day, makes $20 an hour, and as a result, this has interfered with this other person's quality of life. Because when she said she has to take care of her own daughters, the woman says, well, I need you. And she'll call and say, I'm going to be late. And late frequently means 10 or 11 o'clock at night. This woman has her own daughters who are teenagers, but still she's finding she's not giving her own daughters time because she's with this woman, and this woman isn't giving her own daughter any time. That's a phenomena that is rampant, epidemic in our society, and it could be true for couples as well. In this case, it just happens to be professional single women who felt that they would be happier having a child and that it was a missing part of their life. And what I'm looking at is something different. I have a little different perspective on this. To have a child for the right reasons, to give quality time and energy to that child, to be present through all the transitions of that child's development in life, that is fine. That's beautiful, and that's how it should be, and historically was, and in some parts of the world still is. But in our society, not always, but frequently, a child is just another possession. It's another acquisition. It's another trophy. It's another essential add to my living bucket list that I need to get done now. But then, like everything else, when you're that busy, your life is out of balance, and hence your energy is disproportionate. You don't take care of yourself. You don't take care of the people around you. The dog, the cat, they're not going to get the time. The son or daughter's not going to get the time. The brother and sister's not going to get the time. Everything is rushed. Everything is hurried. Everything is always interfered with texts and cell phones. And wait a second, hold on, excuse me, I'll be back in a moment at dinner. And taking as if the world would end without that person taking that call. And then one day you realize that all those important moments that you should have been there have come and gone, and they cannot be relived. More and more parents, I believe, feel that they're a good parent if they buy love. And buying love means that instead of giving what has no value, but is what is most valuable, it has no monetary value, but it's spiritually valuable, give yourself, give your heart, give your insight, give your sense of perspective to that child. They're just giving things. And if you want to know why some of the teenagers today are confused or angry or acting out or insecure or feel abandoned, take a look at the parents. Look carefully, because from the outside you can't always see the truth. You got to look inside. You got to know what's going on in that dynamic. This study just brought this to my attention. Why have a child? What is the purpose if it's not to give unconditional love? And how many children do you have before you have enough? And what happens when you have so many kids that they're not getting the time and attention they need and deserve? Next up, radiation exposure linked to aggressive thyroid cancers. At University of California, they looked at 12,000 people living around Belarus that were exposed as children and adolescents to the fallout in 1986 to Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident. And what they found was the exposure to radioactive iodine is associated with a more aggressive form of thyroid cancer. Quote, our group has previously shown that exposure to radioactive iodine significantly increased the risk of thyroid cancer in a dose-dependent manner. This was according to a professor, MD, PhD, of Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, University of California. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer. Now, why is this important? Because right now, we have the same identical phenomena happening in all of Japan. If you measure how far is Belarus from Chernobyl, and you measure how far is Tokyo, far more populated, the most populous city on Earth, from Fukushima, you'll see why I'm concerned. The Japanese government, pathologically dysfunctional, misogynist, racist, and now creating laws that will imprison you as a journalist, as a scientist, as a physician, if you tell the truth about anything that could embarrass the government, is seeing thyroid cancer in young people that should not have thyroid cancer. That means that you're going to have an entire generation, tens of millions of people susceptible to immunodeficiency diseases and cancers because they're not being told how dangerous this radiation is, because they don't want to destroy the economy or adversely affect the economy by acknowledging that 24/7, for these many years, Fukushima has been spewing radiation into the air, into the water, and into the ground, and that its citizens are all exposed. There's no place you can go in Japan without being exposed to radiation. No place. Not an inch of the land. So what they do is they simply play the game of acceptable exposure. But what is acceptable exposure? There is no such thing as acceptable exposure. This is a myth in science. We did the same thing in the United States when we banned DDT in 1972, and then found out it was in all these women's breast milk. So then we just made a higher threshold before we considered it dangerous. And then when everyone was shown to have that higher threshold, then we made a higher threshold. And then we made it again. We did three adjustments in how much DDT you could have. We do the same thing with other toxins. Oh, you're allowed to have this amount of a toxin or mercury or lead in your body before we consider it a problem. But that's not the only toxin in your body. There's a synergistic effect of having hundreds of toxins. We're exposed to over 250 toxins per day per American. It's all nonsense. It's all corrupt. Completely, our entire scientific establishment has been influenced by the power of money and politics. But especially so when it comes to denying the toxic effects of our nuclear power plants, we should decommission and shut down all 100 active nuclear facilities and all 104 total nuclear facilities, nuclear power plants, and then find permanent deep storage for them. And we should be doing very good independent epidemiological work. I walked down one street just to test this theory in one town in Connecticut near a nuclear facility, and I found four homes on one block where women had cancers, including breast cancer, but they had no risk factors for breast cancer except the fact that they lived very close to a nuclear power plant. Now, one of the women who informed me about this was a woman named Merrill, and her family was the Merrill Lynch, a financial family on Wall Street. And she single-handedly in Connecticut made this a major issue. And because of her financial family's background, she was able to get access to a lot of important people. But then nobody wanted to do anything about it. Even though there was an awareness, nobody wanted to change anything. It's unfortunate. We should close them all down, all power plants that are nuclear. Now, women who eat fruits and vegetables are healthier in their arteries. This is a good thing. Here's what it says, quote, a new study suggests that women who ate a diet high in fresh fruits and vegetables are much less likely to have plaque buildup in their arteries 20 years later. This new finding reinforced the importance of developing healthy eating habits early in life. That's absolutely correct. But it's also possible to have those same healthy habits later in life. And that's what I've been researching and finding. Every day, every single day, I have people stop and tell me about something that's happened in their health that's better, even if they started in their 50s, 60s, or 70s to make changes. And that's important. Remember the woman we had earlier this week on the radio program? Who said that she had reversed a very serious advanced cancer by making substantial modifications in her lifestyle and was 79 years of age. So age is not the limitation you think. And finally, two studies. One is the government researchers, and quote from Cheryl Atkinson, CBS News, and why this is important, she said this in 2006. Here's what she said in her news report. 2006 CBS, quote, an important and definitive mainstream government study done nearly a decade ago got little attention because the science came down on the wrong side. It found that after decades and billions of dollars spent promoting flu shots for the elderly, the mass vaccination program did not result in saving lives. In fact, the death rate among the elderly increased substantially. The authors of the study admitted a bias going into the study. Here was the history as described to me. Public health experts long assumed flu shots were effective in the elderly, but paradoxically, all the studies done failed to demonstrate a benefit. Instead of considering that they, the experts, could be wrong, instead of believing the scientific data, the public health experts assumed the studies were wrong. After all, flu shots have to work, right? So the National Institutes of Health launched an effort to do the definitive study that would have actually proved for the first time, once and for all, that flu shots were beneficial to the elderly. The government would gather some of the brightest scientific minds for the research and adjust for all kinds of factors that could be masking that presumed benefit. But when they finished, no matter how they crunched the numbers, the data kept telling the same story. Flu shots were of no benefit to the elderly. Quite the opposite. The death rate had increased markedly since widespread flu vaccinations among older Americans. The scientists finally had to acknowledge that decades of public health thought had been mistaken. Read the government study that found no flu shot benefit to elderly. In 2006, lead author Lone Simonson spoke with me on the phone and agreed to do an on-camera interview with me on her study results, which she felt were very important. However, her bosses at the National Institutes of Health blocked the interview. I ended up finding one of her co-authors who was independent from the government and was able to interview him. These study authors, who were honest at their own peril, should be commended. After this Simonson study, many international studies have also arrived at the same conclusion. You probably haven't heard about these incendiary findings. Too much money being made promoting flu shots. End quote. That was from Cheryl Atkinson, who's won 6 Emmys, on CBS News. Okay, now, from this really good news piece, and since then, we're talking about 8 years, almost 9 years, we've increased flu shots in the elderly, not decreased them. U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, the FDA and CDC, all of which have an input on vaccination, have refused to be honest. These are organizations that at their core know the truth, the scientists inside, but the political appointees or the career officers perpetuate the pharmaceutical industry that makes these vaccines lies. So there you have a multi-award-winning journalist, Cheryl Atkinson, saying they not only don't help the elderly, they kill the elderly. So just remember that the next time you decide to get a flu vaccine because your doctor or someone else says it's good. By the way, this week we have invited the head of the CDC, the head of the National Institutes of Health, the leading pro-vaccine medical doctor in America on my show to debate me, no one else, just me, on vaccines. Having produced 3 award-winning documentaries, written over 36 articles, I will be only too happy to invite them to share their expertise on how they can prove vaccines are safe or effective when I have every one of their studies and will show them they do not have a single study to prove safety and efficacy for a single individual. And let us hope that they take the opportunity to come on to show that I'm wrong. They will be treated, as all my guests are, with respect and be given an equal amount of time to myself. Also next week on the program, we are expecting Dr. Majid Ali to be here to debate a national recognized medical doctor, professor, board certified, who will take the anti-vaccine position. And Dr. Ali, who is attacked on these airwaves, those who challenge vaccines, he will take whatever position he chooses to take. And they will both be given the same amount of time. I will be moderating it, and that debate will be on Tuesday at noon. Now, And then I have a series of other debates. I'm asking people from ACT UP to come on and debate on AIDS. And we have a lot of other things we're going to be debating on upcoming programs. Now, I'm going to share something with you that ties together several issues, including what I was talking about earlier about, you know, when we have kids, does that make life better? And then what happens when you're in a relationship because you didn't have a good relationship? You had kids thinking that would make it better, and it didn't. Now look at the impact of everyone. This is from Psychology Today. The Root Causes of Stress in Kids by Dr. Tim Elmore. Quote, know why so many kids are stressed out and failing to launch into adulthood? It's because of the unrealistic expectations and mental health of their parents. Now, before you react, let me show you the results from a recent study. Carrie Hummel, a researcher at the University of Kansas, concluded that postpartum depression in mothers and fathers doesn't stem from stretch marks or emotional burden of carrying a new baby. The pressure to be a perfect parent are affecting the mental health of parents. Consider the pressures of today's parents faced to be perfect. We see Facebook pictures of seemingly perfect families who just returned from a perfect vacation, everyone smiling. We compare our lives more than ever to the Joneses next door who just bought their kids the latest iPhones or PS4 or tablet. Mommy bloggers are ubiquitous, consistently pushing readers to perfect their parenting skills and give their kids an advantage in life. We hold Disney-like ideals of how a family is supposed to operate, where mom is always beautiful, dad is a prince charming, etc. We believe that our kids are the report card others examine to measure the kind of parents we are. Wendell Hummel studied the health disorders that come with the parental prenatal phase of a mother's life. During this time, parents must pay particular attention to their mental health. She conducted interviews with new mothers and fathers, most of them from Kansas, Missouri. Their incomes varied from low to middle class. Each candidate reported having issues with a variety of the following symptoms: postpartum depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, psychosis, and bipolar disorder. Interestingly, middle-class parents were more likely to put huge quantities of pressure on themselves to attain a level of perfect parenthood. Middle-class mothers often try to do everything to balance work and home life, and fathers are increasingly attempting to do the same. This pressure can exacerbate mental health conditions. If everything is not perfect, they feel like failures, and mothers tend to internalize that guilt. The pressure from society on middle-class parents seems to be too much for some parents' mental health. Why we can't face failure. Each of the mistakes tends to fall into one of four categories. We risk too little. We rescue too quickly. We rave too easily. We reward too frequently. If you stop to think about it, we parents make these mistakes because we don't want to fail, nor do we want our kids to fail, so we refuse to let it happen. When our kids perform poorly, we praise them anyway. When they forget something, we rescue them. When they finish an average assignment, we rave like they just won a gold medal, assuming it will build self-esteem. This does not produce a healthy adult. So why are we so afraid of failure? If I may be blunt, I believe we as parents and teachers allow our emotional baggage to get in the way of helping them transition into a healthy adulthood. They're unready because we actually failed to get them ready. We are fragile adults, getting offended if anyone, including their teacher, criticizes them. In reality, they likely need some constructive criticism. We interpret our child's poor grade as our failure to parent well, when in reality, they likely failed because they were lazy and didn't fully apply themselves. We're enraged when our kids lose on the playing field because we project our own lives and losses on them. when in reality, a kid just wants a Slurpee when the game's over. He doesn't care nearly as much as we do about who wins. I'm a baby boomer, and I believe that many of our generation, certainly not all, have failed to grow up well. Could it be that we wanted to be called by our first name at work even when we became boss because we were clinging to our youth? Could it be we refused to let our hair become gray because we wanted to stay forever 21? Could it be we were wearing skinny jeans or get tattoos not because we look good in them, but because we hope to stay cool like our kids? Could it be we face midlife crisis because we realize we weren't as awesome as we thought we'd be at 40 years old, and now we're committing to make our kids like this awesome, even if we have to pretend? I'm just asking. I see far too many ill-prepared young adults. The fact is, most of them are loaded with potential, gifts, smarts, creative. But the truth is, we didn't give them a good model to follow into adulthood. Let's work on our own mental and emotional health so our kids know what happy, passionate, satisfied grown-ups look like. Let's drop the perfect expectations. Let's embrace the fact that failure happens to all of us. It's a part of life. And this from Stanford University. Stress girls with a family history of depression age faster than girls with a family history of illness. Published in Molecular Psychiatry, quote, researchers found that girls with a family history of depression had shorter telomeres, a sign of biological aging, and increased hormone response to stress. Numerous studies have suggested a link between stress, depression, and physical changes in the body. Specifically, studies have linked stress to increased risk of depression and depression to premature aging, determined by shortened telomere length. And by the way, this audience knows that telomeres are structures at the end of chromosomes that protect them from deterioration. Telomeres shorten in length as we age, although oxidative stress and other DNA-damaging processes can cause them to shrink. So, the bottom line is, when we grow up in a family where we are not appreciated or loved, where a lot of people are immersed in their own negativity, it creates stress, especially internalized by young girls who then change their biochemistry and are literally prematurely aging them. That is why being able to understand and resolve important issues is important, not to hide them, not to disguise them, and not to throw them upon each other in these angry and rageful fits and tempers. And finally, from our environmental segment, Roundup and birth defects, the public is kept in the dark. This is from the Bullhorn National Change. It says, this report, co-authored by international scientists and researchers, revealed that industry's own studies, including one commissioned by Monsanto, showed as long as the 1980s that Roundup's active ingredient, glyphosate, causes birth defects in laboratory animals. The facts are these. Industry has known from these studies since the 1980s that glyphosate causes malformations in experimental animals at high doses. Industry has known since 1993 that these effects occur at lower and mid doses. The German government has known since at least 1998 that glyphosate causes malformations. The European Commission's expert scientific review panel knew in 1999 that glyphosate causes malformations. And the European Union Commission has known since 2002 that glyphosate causes malformations. This was the year it signed off on the current approval of glyphosate. But none of this information was ever made public. On the contrary, the pesticide industry and European regulators have jointly lied to, misrepresented to the public glyphosate's safety. And let's add up on it that just 2 days ago, a major spokesperson from a PR firm for the GMO industry talked about how to demonize anyone who is anti-GMOs. So Jeffrey Smith, myself, Vandana Shiva, There'll be a relatively small group, and they told the people how to project negative articles. And of course, with Wikipedia, in my opinion, the worst site, and I'm exposing Wikipedia on a major investigative report and showing you the people behind it. Yes, I'll be naming their names. I'm not only naming their names, I'm going to give you their home addresses and their home phone numbers. I'm going to show you how much money they made. You have no idea the depths that this is going to. So all that's coming up. So let's just see what was the guy in? What really good, legitimate business did he get? Was he in? Was it pornography? Okay. We're going to share a lot with you about Wikipedia and the people and this man who was just exposed because someone at the meeting recorded it, and it was all over the internet, and it's all over the world now. Well, this is not the first time that demonizing the people trying to share the truth has come out. It's been going on a long time. Well, the public is not stupid. The public is aware that we have a right to know the truth. Then we can make up our own mind. Where do you get the truth? Do you get the truth when you buy McDonald's? Do you? Now, if you see the ads, they're really well produced. But there's another kind of ad. What if they had an ad for McDonald's that had to tell you the real truth about what you were getting? A little different jingle, a little different take. Here's a person who's going to tell you the truth about McDonald's. Let's see what he says.
Oh, wow. First thing, I just want to say I'm so excited for this opportunity. I've loved McDonald's my entire life. I remember when I was a kid, my parents would...
That's great. We're just doing this for legal reasons, so let's just get this over with.
Yummy, it's McDonald's Chicken McNuggets. All white meat, boneless, factory farm chicken treated with vaccines and hormones.
Just read the ingredients. Don't tell them about the factory farm stuff.
Yummy, it's McDonald's Chicken McNuggets. Chicken, water and salt, enriched flour, yellow corn flour, bleached wheat flour, baking soda, corn starch, wheat starch, modified food starch, dextrose, riboflavin, folic acid, spices, and thiamine mononitrate, which can lead to severe liver damage. Niacin, citric acid, reduced iron, calcium lactate, sodium phosphate, sodium acid pyrophosphate, sodium aluminum phosphate, monocalcium phosphate, all of which are linked to chronic kidney disease, weak bones, and premature death.
Cut.
Why don't you guys just make it out of chicken?
Cut.
Autolyzed yeast extract, which is basically MSG, natural flavoring, which can mean anything, safflower oil, vegetable oil, and hydrogenated soybean oil with TBHQ, a chemical preservative, which is a form of butane and is linked to stomach tumors. And finally, dimethylpolysiloxin, which is a silicone that's used in cosmetics and breast implants and silly putty and to treat head lice. Yummy. McDonald's, eat like a champion.
Well, there's an honest commercial for you. And we're going to do it now for pizzas and some of the other products. But where do you get your honest material? You think you get it on some of the local radio programs, the nonprofit programs, PBS, NPR, Pacifica? Do you? Well, there's one person who is going to do a call-out, and it's long overdue. Abby Martin, RTV, on Rachel Maddow.
Very few people in the corporate media that I actually enjoy watching, and more than just for entertainment. Well, Rachel Maddow is one of those people. She's a seasoned anchor at MSNBC who has a powerful presentation and has made some epic rants. However, she also wouldn't be where she is if she didn't serve a particular role for the establishment. And as critical as she may be of Obama from time to time, at the end of the day, she's there to promote the Democratic Party. Which she does quite well by not only conducting softball interviews with prominent politicians, but by fear-mongering her audience constantly about the GOP. Now, I'm not saying that the Republican Party doesn't deserve ridicule. What I am saying is that both parties are equally complicit in the disastrous policies that are destroying this country. But recently, Maddow has gone beyond her usual partisan politics and is connecting obscure dots to make some pretty startling conclusions in the wake of the Boston bombings.
The headline, and I think also in some ways the bottom line, of the Boston Marathon bombing has been that the reason for the bombing was radical Islam, that the bombers were inspired by the online Al-Qaeda magazines. They committed the bombing for the same cockamamie conspiratorial nonsense that we've all had to become so familiar with. But if this new reporting from the BBC and the Wall Street Journal is correct, that may not have been the only conspiratorial nonsense radicalism that was at work here. I mean, really, pick your poison, right? I mean, it's the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which Tamerlan Tsarnaev also apparently had a nice copy of. It's the protocols of Zion, or it's 9/11 truth, or it's what Anwar al-Awlaki sold to Nedim Ali Kassam. There's always been an appeal to this necrotizing conspiracy theory radicalism, which almost always butts up against justifying violence. Justifying.
Wow. So according to Maddow, conspiracy theories are almost always used as justification for violence. And the Tsarnaev brothers were not radicalized by Islam alone, but were also by conspiracy theories, namely those regarding 9/11. Of course, she forgets to mention that Jokhar himself allegedly said that U.S. foreign policy was the motivating factor behind the attacks, but I digress. Then Maddow compares Anwar al-Awlaki's teachings to people who aren't satisfied with the official 9/11 story. Think about how dangerous that rhetoric is for one second. What does it say about the 9/11 victims' family members who are unfulfilled with the investigation? What about the countless millions of people around the world who are unsatisfied with what the government told us happened and why? Or how about the groups of firefighters, architects, scientists, and world leaders who have also expressed their doubts? Should they all be flagged as potential terrorist threats too? But look, this isn't the first time Rachel has acted as an echo chamber for the government's position on 9/11. She once dedicated a whole segment on her show to just to promote it.
Two of the best things ever published about the 9/11 attacks are these two books. I think that was a really admirable approach to try to make widely accessible the findings of the 9/11 report. But the even better thing they did is that they published an official comic book of the same report. It's the official graphic novel, a graphic adaptation of the real 9/11 Commission report.
Awesome. Thanks for recommending the commission report in its dumbed-down comic book version. Nothing like a cartoon to help digest the propaganda a little bit easier. But Maddow's not just selling propaganda. She's also character assassinating anyone who feels like we haven't been given the truth.
This was written specifically to take on the claims of the people who said that 9/11 didn't really happen, or that 9/11 was an inside job, that 9/11 was not actually an attack on our country, but was rather a hoax perpetrated by our government in order to enslave us or something. So it didn't work. The 9/11 conspiracies have stood up to the facts disproving them. The 9/11 conspiracies have not gone away because they are too ideologically and, I think, emotionally satisfying to the people who espouse them.
Yeah, Rachel, because someone who wants the truth about why things are the way they are must believe that 9/11 either never happened or that it was a hoax or that the government completely engineered every facet in order to enslave humanity. Because apparently it's too hard to believe that this government would not care about the lives of human beings in order to advance geopolitical goals. Is it really too hard to believe the fact that Bush and his cabinet turned a blind eye to let the attacks happen or even ensure that they happened? According to Maddow, it's somehow more comforting for people to accept the view that the government would allow them to die to justify war. But wait a minute, isn't that exactly what she thinks?
That is why the new bombshell reporting by Kurt Eichenwald, which ran as an op-ed in today's New York Times, but is also in his new book, is so important. Mr. Eichenwald, in reporting for this new book, says it was not just that famous bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. presidential daily briefing that the Bush administration received and ignored less than a month before 9/11, just over a month before 9/11. It was a whole series of presidential daily briefs all through May and June and July of 2001, all warning of a planned major strike by al-Qaeda in the United States. which then, of course, ultimately happened in September of that year. There's a responsibility to get history right for its own sake, right?
Yes, Rachel, it is. And letting 9/11 happen is making it happen. And I commend you for being critical of war, critical of many of the empire's destructive policies. But until you start asking questions about what drives these policies, you're doing nothing more than perpetuating them.
Just to mention that this has been a tactic not just on the corporate right, but the corporate left. Any reasoned, intelligent dialogue of asking serious and germane questions about the official 9/11 report, you're merely immediately cast as a conspiratorialist. There are over 3,000 scientists, architects, and first responders who now question the official report. They're not saying who did what. They're simply saying that what you told us happened doesn't hold it. There's not the science there. We need a quality, independent report. That's what people are saying. But that's even too much for these people. And where are all your reports that we have sent, the documentaries, on showing you Big Pharma's impact? Haven't happened. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take your calls now on TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. While we're doing that, just a couple program announcements real quick. Tomorrow, my noon workshop on how to survive a solar storm is full, packed. So I'm doing one last one at 3 o'clock, and that will be gone within a few minutes. You can call 646-926-5422. Also, for our fundraising premiere for WBAI's helping it with our new film, Poverty, Inc., a powerful, powerful full-feature film, a long film, almost 2 hours long, for 35 showings. Over half are now full. I'll be at the every night at the two evening ones, 7 and 9:30. Call to get your seat. You will not see any other film like this. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. And here's something brand new. I was listening the other day, and Amy Goodman was offering, people offered $2,000, chance to come by, have some fair trade coffee, watch her show, and then have a meal somewhere later where they, you know, would share some positive conversation. Good. I certainly support that. But then I thought, well, how many people can afford $2,000 for dinner? So here's what I'm doing. I'm going to offer, as a fundraiser to WBAI, dinner, a movie, or a Broadway play for $100. But here's how it works. Listen carefully. For $100, which you'll make your check or credit card or cash out to WBAI, you will pay for your meal, and you'll pay for the movie or play. And that way, I'm setting aside starting Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Saturday, and then the following Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So that way, you pay for your own, because last time I did this, we had a great success, raised a lot of money for the station, but the station never reimbursed me for the meals, the cabs, the Broadway plays, so I'm out thousands of dollars. I'll never get it back, and that's okay. I mean, I just accept that's business is normal. But this way, for $100, you get to have a whole evening with people. These have always been wonderful. The people are phenomenal, great times. So that's it. $100 that goes to the station, and that should bring in probably $10,000, $15,000 at the station, and you pay for your own meal. You pay your own way that night, but it won't be that expensive. You know, let's say a movie's $15, a dinner's $25. So for $140, it's a whole evening instead of $2,000. So I figure a lot more people can afford $100 for an evening, and it's not just dinner. It's dinner and a movie, or if you want, a Broadway show. All right? But this way, I don't spend thousands of dollars and out of my pocket, never get any of it back. So this way, it'll be a great time, and it will raise money for the station. All right? Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and let's say hello to Benjamin from New York. Hi, Benjamin. Your turn.
Hello, Gary. My grandfather, his parents were first cousins, so my grandfather, I don't think, had the best genetic makeup, and he died in his 50s. I was wondering how it affects me and if there's anything I can do to help me.
There's a lot you can do. Look, all of us, well, not all of us, most people have some form of marker that could be a limiting factor. But more often than not, it has to do with how families lived. For example, when I was living in Pennsylvania, small little mining town of Katanning, Pennsylvania, it was mainly Polish miners, and they ate almost all the same foods. They celebrated life. They dealt with issues the same way. And heart disease was rampant. Now, if you moved out of that environment and if you changed your diet, then there's no reason to believe that based upon the science of genetics that you couldn't change the gene expression. And we've seen that. That's been proven time and again through epigenetics. So yes, you can be affected by your genetics, but it's more the message inside your gene rather than the gene itself. So if you create a new environment, a better place, a new way of looking at life, a happier disposition, then you will not be a prisoner to someone else's limited gene expression in the vast majority of cases. Okay, all the best to you, Benjamin. And let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann. Oh, Luann's not there? All right. Well, I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for joining us today. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone. Let's say hello to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hi, Gary. Today, of course, it's Halloween, and the only thing scary is the analysis we'll get of the week's events from listeners calling in on Free Your Mind Friday.
Great. You, Therese Lead, right now.